Yes.
Do you feel that there are still markers to the cause of Christianity?
Yes, we know there are martyrs today, that there are people who have died for the faith behind the Iron Curtain from Central Europe through China. Countless numbers, and in Africa as well. They are being martyred for the faith. And of course, the word martyr, we must remember, means witness, literally. So that, in the strict original sense of the word, whenever we suffer for the faith to any degree, we are martyrs. The martyrs of the early church, many of them died for the faith, and there are those who are dying for it today. But all who witness for the faith and suffer for the faith in any degree are martyrs. And the Te Deum says, the noble army of martyrs, praise thee. Yes.
Did John Knox ever meet Calvin?
Yes, he was in Geneva for a time and sat under Calvin's ministry. He went to Geneva and there absorbed the faith firsthand before he went to Scotland. Yes.
Speaking of confusing, I wonder if you read an article in the paper the other day about some physicians who were having a seminar or something, and Dr. Greenblatt was making very light of things in the Bible, and he said that most physicians held that St. Paul was an epileptic, but his diagnosis of St. Paul was that he suffered from heat stroke. That's why he had visions and,
Yes, well, he is far from original. This story about Paul supposedly being an epileptic is over 100 years old, and it was invented by a number of scholars who were out to prove that there was no truth to the Bible, that Jesus was totally a myth, and Paul was an epileptic who had wild dreams and therefore created Christianity, and so on. A lot of nonsense. I think anyone who repeats these is self-condemned. They are making a fool of themselves and revealing that only one thing motivates them: hatred.
They described him as the father of the medical Harry Golden, so that was the
tip-off. Yes.
Back to this, you can't win statement. Well, don't our scientists today think that they can win? That's resistance consciousness. I mean, they're trying to create life in a test tube, and they're going to decrease people so they can live a long time, and this and this and that.
Right.
This is an evolution. I mean, Darwin, is that correct? Has that not changed, though? I mean,
yes. A very good question. Why do the scientists today dream that they can create life, eliminate death, and so on? Are they breaking with this philosophy of you can't win? Well, of course, in the Roman Empire, they also believed that they were going to create a heaven on earth. The answer to that is that humanistic man is basically schizophrenic. He, on the one hand, professes that this is the great and brave new world he's going to create. On the other hand, he moves suicidally in all that he does. So that the more he dreams about destroying everything that makes for death and for defeat, the more he courts everything that does. Now, we are talking today, as in no generation in recent times, about defeating all the problems that confront man. But have we ever worked more zealously to create problems that are destined to defeat man? This is the insanity of humanism. We are doing deliberately those things which are going to ensure the destruction of our hopes.
Along with my somebody was saying the other day that they are going to find a way to do away with the common house fly because they can't seem to find one single thing that it does that's good. So why have it? So what I was wondering, does the Bible speak about this? I mean, let's say that one could eliminate a certain animal or a snake or an insect or something. Perhaps these things work together, all of them, every single one of them, and a plan that...
Right. Well, there was an article on the common housefly in the Scientific American in the past year, and the authors admitted that they hadn't found any convincing evidence yet that the housefly is guilty of all the things charged to it. They were sure it must be, but so far they haven't turned it up. So they were unwilling to acquit him, but they couldn't indict him. So the poor housefly, apart from being a nuisance, doesn't have too serious an indictment against it, as things stand now. Yes?
Well, the eggs turn into maggots, and if you have nothing around, you're wounded, you put the maggots in the wound, that'll sterilize them.
Yes.
That's one thing good.
Well,
any port in the store.
True.
Yes.
On a slightly different point, I noticed in some of the new versions of the Bible that the word charity is now changed to love. From my connotation, I would feel that charity has much more of a meaning than actually the simple word of love.
Yes, that raises a very difficult question of translation. In a sense, it is a justifiable translation, but it is a confusing one. Now, the word charity is from the Vulgate translation because the original King James Version as well as the Douay both had charity rather than love, because they were influenced by the Vulgate, which gave it as caritas. Now, the Vulgate, however, was a translation of the Greek Testament. Now, the Greek Testament, where it reads caritas, actually has agape, and sometimes philia, two different words. Now, the word actually is love in the Greek, but there are three Greek words for love. Two of them are used in the Bible, or in the New Testament, which is the Greek portion. One is eros, from whence we get the word erotic and eroticism. This is not used in the Bible. The second is phileo, from whence we get the word Philadelphia. Phil, love. Adelphos, brother, city of brotherly love. Now, this is often used in the Bible, and it means the human kind of love which we have for our family, our children, for one another. The third word which is used was a word which is a strange word. It was in the Greek but had practically no usage. It is almost, some scholars have said, as though the word were prepared and waiting for the Bible to come along when it had its first real usage. And that means agape, the divine love, divine grace, which reaches out to undeserving man. Now, it could be rendered as charity, but charity has the connotation of something human. Charity is something we exercise one towards another. But that's the trouble with the word love, too. So while it's originally love in the original, again, love in the English, there's only one word for three words in the Greek. So love as it is in the Bible can absorb the wrong kind of meaning of eros and philia. It could be rendered also, in a sense, as grace. This perhaps might be the best. It isn't literally the same word as grace, but it is closer in meaning to grace than it is to love and to charity. This is a problem in biblical translation that is a tremendous one. In most cases, English has been remolded and remade so that it has become an excellent language for conveying the biblical words and ideas, except at this crucial point. This is almost the one problem case. There are a few others, but this is the basic one. But you can see what a problem it makes in translating the Bible into many languages today, where the people have no background of Christianity, where the language very often doesn't even have a word for God, let alone grace and charity, for example. A host of words for which there is absolutely nothing in these languages. This has been a problem, for example, even in such cultures, well, especially in China. China is such a relativistic culture, it's been very difficult to translate many of the biblical words into Chinese. And this is true also of Japanese. And sometimes it leads to very grave difficulties as they translate and find that the word has connotations they never understood. A little humorous sideline on that, not with translation of the Bible, but speaking. A missionary who went to Japan began to preach at a service, and he was anxious to show off his command of Japanese. He had studied very extensively, and he was distressed that the women, who are very quiet normally, were beginning to titter and giggle. And the men were vastly delighted and amused. And when he ended, he found out that he was speaking of Christ as their Savior of sins, but actually he was saying, because the two words sin and wife were so similar, tsumi and tsuma, he was saying Christ was saving them from their wives. Translation is a problem, and it is hard to know what to do in this particular case, what the proper answer would be. Yes?
To go back to the statement about Paul, recently I ran into a surprising interpretation of the life of Luther. A well-informed friend declared to me that Luther was a little insane. And I'd never run across this before, and I stated to her that I thought probably it was some author that she read that who naturally would want to downgrade him. Is there a current belief about
that? Oh, yes. You see, all of the great men of the church, as well as the great figures of the Bible, have been subjected to this. There's been quite an extensive body of literature, and one considerable book as well, from the Freudian perspective, written to prove that Luther was characterized by anal fixation, and that everything in Luther's life and theology is to be interpreted in terms of anal fixation. Now, it is the weirdest kind of literature imaginable, and all you can say is that there is fixation in the minds of the writers. But it is fantasy. But this kind of literature, there's a vast body of it. And there have been books written to demonstrate from the psychiatric point of view that Jesus was insane. And Schweitzer wrote a defense of the mental health of Jesus, Albert Schweitzer, which leaves him, I think, in a sorrier state than the critics did. Yes. Yes, and so much of the material is so thoroughly manufactured today, out of whole cloth. If you stand in terms of Christian orthodoxy and conservatism today, you can be sure you are going to be abused and slandered if you acquire any position of prominence in such a stand, or if you aggravate anyone around you for such a stand. This is a certainty.
Well, we don't have to believe that all these people were perfect. They certainly had some faults because they were
human. Right. But they were good and godly men, and the faults that are ascribed to them definitely were not there. Luther was a marvelous and lovable man. He certainly was not guilty of these weird things that are ascribed to him. And the same is true of Calvin, the same is true of Athanasius, the same is true of Augustine, of a host of great men of the church. Yes?
Would you explain something about the young person, do they still exist, or would they normally change from that religious sect to Unitarianism? Is there a connection?
No. The Dunkards are one of the Anabaptist groups from two or three centuries ago. There still are Dunkards in, I believe, the Middle West. But it is not normal for them to become Unitarians. Yes?
Just a little aside, what we're going to talk about this all fits in. Last time we were talking about history, or one time recently, and I often have puzzled in my mind that this business of history will prove a man right or wrong. Now, I heard Kleinby make the statement that history depends on who was writing it. And to a certain extent, he was right, because you know a lot of things that you read that where you were actually witness to the school that started, that you can't hardly recognize yourself.
So, yes.
How are they going to fix the truth from the untruth as time goes on? It's more obscure all the time, isn't it?
Except as you go to the original sources. Now, the problem, of course, of our time is that humanism is busy rewriting all of history. And as a result, history is, and has been for a century at least, very markedly for a century, and much longer than that, but on a gradual break, been subjected to a rewriting. We do have the original documents of men such as, for example, the councils, the church fathers. We have their records of the events, the minutes of meetings, so we can get to an accurate writing of history. But this is not what men are interested in.
Well, that brings up, in those days, there wasn't as much, in the past, there had been distortion, but there wasn't as general as it is now.
That's
right. And if you go back to the source, you depend on being somewhat accurate. If you go back to the source now, you don't know just exactly what is the source.
Exactly.
For instance, the Kennedy assassination has stirred up an awful furor, and they claim that the Lincoln assassination sure that the central one is.
Right.
It's right out of the middle.
Yes, what you've had increasingly in the past few generations is a deliberate suppression of evidence. Previously, there often would be bitter factionalism, but now there is the deliberate suppression of evidence. So, in many respects, it's harder to know, far harder to know what's going on today than it is to know what happened 1,000 and 2,000 years ago. I'd like to read something now to you in the remaining minutes. This week I was in Bakersfield speaking at a luncheon at the Americanism Center, and before that I was for an hour and 40 minutes on the call-in radio program Open Line, and I found that vastly interesting and delightful. The announcer who was conducting the program, Don G., is a good man, and it was quite entertaining. We were talking about education, and he took a little time to describe one of his experiences. He said his oldest child is a girl, 5 years old, in kindergarten. The child was disappointed on going to school because she expected to learn how to read. So he sat down and taught her. So she reads. And he has been given all kinds of static by the school administration. Supposedly he has done something terrible. A child at that age, he is told, cannot learn how to read. It warps the child and stunts it and so on and so forth. And he said, now this is a curious thing. He said, you know, I was a commercial pilot until 2 years ago, and I may go back into it. I got weary of being away from home so much, and that's why I stepped out for a time. But he said, I have my own plane, and I fly regularly. And from the time my little girl could walk, I took her up. And now at the age of 5, she can take that plane up, fly it around, and land it herself. But they tell me she's too young to learn how to read. Now, one of the women there brought me the teacher's edition of, I believe it's the first grade reader, Our Town. And she said, take it and read it, and you'll see what is being done to the morality of our children. Now, here is one story that I think is short enough and yet revealing enough to give you the idea. The Funny Little Man. One morning, a funny little man was hurrying down the road. He was dressed all in yellow from his hat to his shoes. He sang and sang and sang, I am a little man, I am, I am, I am, but I can do anything, I can, I can, I can. The little man met a hen. Why are you singing that? Asked the hen. You cannot do what I can do. The hen made a nest of grass. She sat down on the nest, and soon there was an egg in it. The little man sat on the nest. When the hen was not looking, he took a ball out of his pocket. He let the ball drop into the nest. Look at that egg, he said. It is 5 times as big as yours. Next, the little man met a cat. The cat was playing with a ball. First she hit it this way, then she hit it that way. Once she hit it too far, she had to go and look for it. Why look, said the little man. Why not make the ball find you? Sit down and I will show you how. When the cat was not looking, he took an orange from his pocket. Here is your ball, he said. See, I made it find me. The little man came to a house. I hear a happy sound, he said. I hear the sound of someone fixing dinner. Then he looked in the window and saw a girl at work. He saw her put an orange, an egg, and some milk on the table. Why don't you have some cookies for dinner too, asked our friend. If you will let me come in and sit down, I will make them for you. The girl let the little man come in and sit down. He put his hat on the table, then he said, bring me 5 eggs, bring me 5 oranges, bring me 5 peanuts. I will make the cookies in my hat. I can make them faster that way. The little man put the oranges, eggs, and peanuts into his hat. Then he put on the hat. They will be ready soon, he said. When the girl was not looking, he took 2 cookies from his pocket. The cookies are ready, he said. Why don't you eat one today and one tomorrow? I saw you take those cookies out of your pocket, said the girl. Give me back all of those eggs and oranges and peanuts. If you don't, I will hit you with one of my shoes. But the little man did not hear. He was much too far away by that time, much too far. And he sang as he ran with his dinner in his hat, I can do anything, I can, I can, I can. Now, this little man who is called our friend, of course, is a good con man. Then in the guided reading suggestions for discussion, the children are to say what made the little man funny, and so on and so forth. Why did he sing as he ran? Which trick was the funniest? Which person or animal was the silliest? In other words, this little man, our friend, is to give them a standard, and they are to judge these other people in terms of the conduct of our friend, the little man. Now, for little children, this is very plain indoctrination into something that we cannot call biblical morality. This is from the reader, Our Town. What? I think it is Allen and Bacon, yes. The Sheldon Basic Reading Series.
What year?
1957.
No, I mean, what the school?
First grade and still in use. The first reader program.
Was there any discussion of the land of the free?
What's that?
The book, The Land of the Free, was there any discussion about that on the children?
Oh, yes. And I pointed out exactly what is taking place today, namely that Max Rafferty is threatening the Pasadena School Board that if they will not adopt it, he's going to sue them. And I think it is significant that a liberal, Herb Cain, in San Francisco, when he reported it, concluded with this observation, land of the free, question mark.
Why is Max Rafferty doing that? Is he being forced to do it?
No. Max Rafferty is one of the few genuine, honest civil rights champions in the state of California. He has criticized the civil rights movement for its excesses more plainly than others, but he has approved of it more than others as well. This is an honest conviction on his part. And the book, of course, is written from the civil rights revolution perspective. It was written to order at the request of the State Board of Education to fulfill that function. It does it beautifully. He is therefore for it. Now, you may think he is wrong here, but I do believe he believes this, as other politicians do not. I think also he is very wrong at this point.
Well, the authors themselves have admitted that
they're
socialists.
Oh, yes, their record is clear cut.
They have admitted, so the book is not only written from the civil rights point of view, but from a very socialistic
and a humanistic perspective. It is a very beautifully written book, as I've said before, and it will be deadly in its effect. A number of school districts are hostile to it. The Bakersfield district, I understand, is against the book, but they are going to be compelled to use it. And it does not look as though the present administration is going to do anything to prevent it from adoption.
Well, how about this?
Oh, but we don't have any civil rights.
Do you remember the time that Rafferty studied, I think, with James B. Coleman and Neagle, aren't they together?
No, I don't know anything about that.
I can't remember the date, the time that this happened. I think it was James B. Coleman. I think it was in Neagle.
I don't know that, but I think we can rejoice in this. What this book is doing is to settle more clearly the destiny of the public schools. There is going to be a major exodus because this book is a little too raw for many, many parents. And in every area, there is an increasing interest in private education, in Christian education, in parochial schools, in rebellion against the implications of this book, because it is such open indoctrination.
The indictment that I saw against this book was even more serious, was the fact that there was no, the authors admit that they spent a tremendous amount of time on the early history of the country, but they gave no description of our form of government. In fact, they even left out the phrase out of the Declaration of Independence, which shows that our government is based on the concept of endowed rights. Now, there's nothing of that in the book. There's nothing about limitations on government. There's actually no exposition of our form of government.
No, you're absolutely right. What they do is to take the Civil Rights Revolution and go back to the Pilgrims and read everything from that time to the present in terms of the Civil Rights Revolution. So naturally, there's no place for the Christianity of early colonial and constitutional America. There is nothing for the limited powers concept of government. No room. It's all in terms of statism. The great friend of man is the all-powerful state. This shows from beginning to end. It would be possible to write 10 volumes correcting the errors of the book because its perspective is so warped. But it is the textbook of the state now for 8th graders. And there's no getting around that. I see no possibility of it being withdrawn.
That's kind of crazy. We're going to get before things break down. I was reading the morning paper about the flat houses in Cape Town, and they restricted everybody to vote because of apartheid. And then we see college professors doing research on the stupidest things imaginable. I mean, I could imagine what my wife would say if I was doing research on that, and they'd say, what's your husband doing?
That's very true. It's getting more and more absurd, and it will continue until it breaks down, because as long as people are finding that this feeds them and makes them rich, they'll go along with it. That's the sad fact, and it's going to have to fall apart before they wake up, and it will. And they'll find then that they've been fed not the bread of life, but stones. There's a good verse in the scriptures that to a sinner the bread of deceit is sweet in the mouth, but afterwards it shall be as gravel under one's feet. And that's the way it shall be.
Speaking of education, Harvey Cox told a group this week that we had to rearrange our standards because there were so many youngsters were dropping out because they couldn't actually get enough of the new morality. He didn't say it in those words, but that's what he meant.
Yes. Well, I think it is significant that the state in the Union, which has the least problem of discipline in the schools, is New Mexico. Now, it isn't that they have a superior population, but it is this. Unless they've changed it in the last year or two, New Mexico has a very low compulsory education age limit. I believe they can drop out at 12. This means that any child in the upper grades who misbehaves can be kicked out of school, so that if they're going to stay, they have to behave. Otherwise, they are bounced. Well, of course, they stay and behave. But in our state and elsewhere, where they know they cannot be kicked out, they misbehave, and they disrupt the whole educational process so that they frustrate the very purpose of compulsory education. And this is the way it always has been. If you're going to have compulsory education supposedly for the education of children, what you're doing is to destroy the education of children. You put it on the wrong basis. Well, yes, it is a religious sect, although it claims not to be. It is humanism compounded. It is a form of humanism which, like others, claims that man becomes a god. It is, on top of that, an esoteric cult. It believes that there is a hidden way to this power, which only the initiates know. Yes?
As you were talking, it seems to me when they got across the idea that the Christians and the Jews and the other religions were worshiping the same God, this was a tremendous wedge against Christianity. I'm wondering, number one, when did this start creeping in? Were the council busy working at this sort of thing? And my minister is currently very much misled along this line, and he's a fine minister. He's a marvelous sermon, surface sermon. But when he was in the service, the chaplain in the service, he had servicemen who were Jewish come to him and attend his services because there wasn't a Jewish rabbi in the church. He took care of all of them. He found that they were very devout young men. So he was very much in the feeling that we're worshiping the same God. And then recently he was talking to a Jewish man who evidently went through the Hitler era, who believed that the Jews were exterminated. And this particular man asked my minister, where was your God when these 6 million were exterminated? Now that would indicate to me that he doesn't recognize that. Where was your God? He would say, where was our God? Now, there must be some religions too who don't want the triune God. Is that not true?
There is no religion that wants the triune God except Orthodox Christianity. And this business of saying that the God of Mohammedanism and the God of Judaism and of these other religions is the same as the God of Scripture is nonsense. Basically, it crept into Christian thought in the Middle Ages through a Jewish scholar, Maimonides, who was an Aristotelian. Now, the basic premise is that there is truth in all religions and that all religions are basically one and that they are man's way to God. So that some men take one way and other men take another way, but they're all headed for the same place. Of course, this assumes that man makes his way and man's way is valid. Now, if you grant that premise, then they are right. But if the Bible is true, it's God who makes the way, and the way is Jesus Christ, and there is none other way. So that they are all false if they deny that God-appointed way. This, of course, is so prevalent today that you have increasingly the drive towards the one-world religion. Because if this premise is true, then the one world religion is the logical conclusion. It will bring all of man's ways together so that man can then pick and choose the way that is most fitting for him. And there are those who believe that the ideal cathedral of the future will be one which will have many chapels in it. So that if you want this week to try the so-called Christian way, you can, and next week you can try the Buddhist way, and then the Shinto way, and then the Muslim way, and the Hindu way, and perhaps they'll even have a chapel for the cannibal way in the Cathedral of Man. But this is the basic drive. And It is a question. Is it man who makes the way or God who does? If God is the one who makes the way to him, then that way is Jesus Christ. And the Bible is right. There is none other name under heaven by which men may be saved.
Well, I think it's a good theologian to misled on this. I can understand the students in college, all of us, but somebody who's studying the Bible so much. I mean, it's just...
Well, the point is, there are very few good theologians around. First, they do not get much Bible or real theology. That's an important point. They get very little. They get training in churchmanship, how to organize a parish, how to keep people in line. Second, they busy themselves so much with building up the parish that they never sit down and study. So that each year as they get away from seminary, they are a little rustier on that which they should preach. In fact, there are some clergymen who move every few years because when they left seminary, they worked out a set of sermons and they would have to work out another set. And to avoid repeating themselves, they go to another church. So it is nothing more nor less than abysmal ignorance. The work of the councils, for example, which is so basic, is unknown. The Bible is unknown.
Does the congregation have something to do with this too? No, because I've gotten into arguments. You can always get in an argument very readily with it. People want to be very kind, I guess, to the other religions and feel that they're not going to be left out. They seem to get into the wicked.
That yes.
To say that, you know, people can't go together.
Yes, we are so thoroughly saturated with humanism that to be unkind to anybody, including the Chinese Reds today, is considered a sin. But to be unkind to God is nothing. You can despise his word and despise his God-given order, and that's nothing. It's man who must be obeyed, man who must be loved and served and worshipped. It is this total saturation by humanism that colors most churchmen. I would say that 99 out of 100 people in church today are humanists rather than Christianity, than Christians, because it is humanism they are exposed to week in and week out. Yes.
How much of humanism can you absorb and still be a Christian?
Well, that isn't a question that can be readily answered, but the minute you begin to absorb humanism, you are beginning to depart from Christianity. It's God or man. Which do we worship? Yes. We are saturated with it today. And this is why coexistence is so appealing a doctrine to people today. You can tell them, and they know what communism has done. But humanism calls for coexistence because you've got to have peace with your fellow men. Now, currently, there is a tremendous drive on by various scholars, as well as by politicians in Washington. Toynbee has recently written a very, very major study calling for an end to the Cold War and immediate union between the Soviet Union and the United States to establish world peace. Now, he says, of course, this will bring about tyranny in the United States. We're going to lose a great deal that we have here. But think of the incalculable benefit. Humanity will be united. And when you consider that through history there have been centuries when people have been under tyranny, it won't hurt the people of the United States to live under tyranny for a few generations until this one world order can work itself out to this perfect society that is its goal. And after all, over there as well as here, we're united in wanting that perfect world for man. Yes.
Exactly what
counties
have been
doing
for 50 years.
Of course. Exactly. Of course. Yes.
I don't know what I brought 100 times before.
Oh, yes, but of course now it is a matter of national policy. It has been so stated by the president. So it's not merely a matter of the philosophers and the radicals talking. It has been declared by President Johnson that the Cold War belongs to a past generation. Yes?
Russia, the Pharisees attempted to lay their hands on Jesus earlier. Did he, how was his escape affected? Was it a disappearance or what?
We are not told. There isn't given any indication that it was a disappearance, but that somehow, miraculously, he slipped through the crowd and lost himself in it, because his time had not yet come, we are told. Yes?
In that fourth point, you mentioned the theory of transubstantiation, but I didn't quite understand what this means.
Well, that the human elements in the sacrament are divinized.
You mean the bread and
yes.
Wine
yes.
They actually turn to the
they become elements of God's body. Mm-hmm. This was the statement that was made by the heretics, yes.
When you were describing the attempt of humanism to infiltrate the church, it sounded as the neo-orthodox of today. This is the latest movement, apparently, that's really taking over. Is that correct?
Right. We are seeing the same thing today. In fact, you might say they have taken over virtually every segment of the church today. Yes.
How is it that Christians have been so compromised that they constantly apologize for the teachings of Christ? I mean, I don't understand. If you really believe in Christ's teaching, if you really are a Christian, then you cannot apologize for the fact that Christ said, "I am the way. Only through me can you get to God." And yet, I find people constantly, people who consider themselves Christians, saying, "Oh, well, you know,
I would say their education is behind this. They have been reared in a humanistic form of education in state schools. As a result, everything in them has been converted to humanism, and they maintain the facade of Christianity. So they try to reinterpret Christianity in terms of humanism. Now, they are doing it naively, whereas these theologians then and theologians now, Karl Barth, Tillich, and others, are trying to do it with sophistication, but it's the same thing. It is humanism, and they don't realize it.
Was Christianity such a hard thing to swallow and follow that, you know, good Christians have to, good Christians have to, look around and flounder around at some of these other spiritualistic threats? And I mean, doesn't Christianity take them far enough that they have to go looking
for? Well, of course, they have not been taught. How much real teaching is there now in the Bible and in Christian doctrine? There is virtually none. Virtually none. So, if the people are not fed, how are they going to know?
Well, Dorothy, I think her name is Faber, the Episcopalian.
Yes.
I heard her say that the downfall of Christianity started with the Sunday school, that the parents gave up studying their own Bible and teaching their own children the Bible, and they delegated it to the church to teach the children. Now, it's come that people just don't read their Bibles anymore, and that's the reason they can't take this as the
And there's a great deal of truth to that. That came about at a time when you had several things occurring at one and the same time. You had the transition in this country from Calvinism and Augustinianism to Arminianism. You had the transition from Christian schools to state schools. You had the transition from family covenant teaching within the home of the faith to Sunday school teaching, so that the family ceased to concern itself and put the burden on the Sunday school and on the public school for the moral and religious training of the child. The family abdicated. The church abdicated. Humanism triumphed. There are some questions here in written form that I'd like to deal with now, briefly. The first, does a spiritual compact form the basis of all societies worthy of being called a society? The answer to that, of course, is definitely yes. Because every society and every state has a system of laws. And every law presupposes a morality. A law says something is forbidden and something, therefore, is required. In other words, it deals with basic principles of conduct. And morality rests on religion, so that there is a theological premise to societies. And the premise is either Christianity, or it is humanism, or it is some other form of religious principle. So that a spiritual compact, the word that is used here, is in a sense the basis of all societies. It would be better to say there is a theological premise, a theological faith which undergirds every society. The second, if so, what was the spiritual compact of the United States and when did it die out? The answer to that, again, is that in its origins, the United States began on a theological foundation, thoroughly Christian. And when the United States came into existence, it presupposed and accepted this theological foundation. There was no religious statement in the Constitution because the Constitution was not the basic government. The states and the counties were. And every state had a theological premise. In every state, you had a clearly Christian principle. For example, we assume very often that the New England states, yes, they were very puritanical, but this was not true of Virginia, where you had the Cavalier tradition. Well, the reality is that when the Constitution was adopted, and for some time thereafter in Virginia, you could not be a citizen or a voter if you denied the infallibility of Scripture and the doctrine of the Trinity. In fact, if you denied these things, you could even have your children taken from you for their welfare. You could not testify in any court as a witness for someone else if you did not believe in Christianity. The laws with regard to this testimony have only been struck down within the last 2 or 3 years in some states. Now, this premise gave way to humanism, so that whereas the established religion of the United States was Christianity, even though no church was established, the established religion of the United States, in terms of Supreme Court decisions for a good many years now, has been humanism. This began after the Civil War, and it has been moving very steadily since. I deal with one aspect of this, the transition from common law, which was Christian law, to statute law in one of my broadcasts, which will be given 2 weeks from tonight. The real legal revolution began when that transition was made, and it was made very rapidly after the Civil War in this country. when the late Chief Parker said we had witnessed a legal revolution. What he was speaking about was the tail end mopping up action of that legal revolution. Third, since it has died out and authority from God recognized by society at large along with it, leaving only sheer power as authority, is not the Christian's role to be that of a prophet rather than a conservative? For what or who can he appeal to for a tradition, authority, or moral standard in an age when society has no common spiritual basis? That's a long question, and there are a number of parts to it. But briefly, society today has a common spiritual basis. It is humanism. Humanism is the established religion of the United States and of the several states, of the Supreme Court, and of the public schools, and of the churches. Certainly, the Christian's role is that of a prophet in the face of this, but also that of a conservative. Because the legal background is still there to a degree. For example, the Constitution. Now a liberal like Edward S. Carwin, in his book, The Higher Law Background of the U.S. Constitution, admitted that the Constitution presupposed the higher law of God and God as the ultimate appeal. This was the background. This was the presupposition. We still have a background of common law has not been entirely abolished, so that we can be conservative. In other words, we have enough there legally that we can hark back to, attempt to reestablish and strengthen. We need to be prophetic, however, in speaking for God against the humanistic establishments which are crowding out the Christian. Now, we have sheer power as an authority because sheer power is the product of our new establishment, humanism. When humanism says that man is God, man is ultimate, then there can be no law above and over man, and the will of man is the only law. Man is over law rather than under law, and sheer power is therefore the product of humanism. As a result, we do have a major task. Statism is again reestablishing itself because wherever you do not have Orthodox Christianity, you have the revival of statism. The state as man's savior versus Christ as savior. Our role in this situation, therefore, is both conservative and prophetic. Yes.
But he couldn't possibly be a true conservative, if you didn't have a Christian, if you weren't a Christian.
Right.
Now, a lot of these people say they're conservative, but they don't have any real philosophical basis for their...
Exactly. A true conservative must be a Christian, because if he's trying to conserve anything here, it has to be the Christian background. Now, many who call themselves conservatives are basically humanists, but they are conservative humanists. That is, they prefer the humanism of a generation ago to the extreme form of our day. Now, more than a century ago, Stirner wrote a book on humanism, The Ego and His Own, I believe. And he ridiculed the halfway humanists. And he said, you're for abolishing God, and you are for abolishing the church and all moral teaching, but you're not ready to take the logical step and to affirm there is no law. You're not ready to say that marriage must be abolished, that any kind of sexuality, including the perversions and incest, are thereby legitimate. You are cowardly humanists. You simply want to abolish God, but to maintain some of the forms that God has established. And he said you won't be allowed to. And he was right. What these conservatives are doing, these so-called conservatives, is to affirm humanism, but they want it to retain the Christian virtues without Christ. And this is ridiculous. Of all the people on the current scene, these non-Christian humanists are the most ridiculous.
You spoke of this premise of our forefathers that our government was based on the Christian faith. There is a residual of that in the Constitution, in the preamble. It speaks of blessings to mankind, and the word blessings are gifts of God. So it would have to be, and then in the conclusion of the Constitution, it speaks of being signed in the year of our Lord. At the very beginning, at the very end, you see this premise. While there isn't any direct relationship, it's still observable in the Constitution.
One of the points which for generations revealed the intensely Christian nature of this country most was the presidential oath of office. Now, the oath of office is still taken on the Bible, but we've forgotten what an oath means and what it involved in taking it. I think it is tonight or next Sunday night I'll be dealing with this subject, not directly with oaths, but what an oath involves. It involves invoking either the blessing of God for obedience or the curse of God for disobedience. Now, this is the meaning of an oath. So that when an oath of office was taken, it was on an open Bible, usually opened to Deuteronomy 28. Open that and read it, and you'll see what it involves. And I believe it is tonight I'm dealing with that. You invoke the blessing of God if you obey him. Blessed be thy going in and thy coming forth, the fruit of thy body and the fruit of thy field, and so on. And if you disobey, you invoke the curse of God upon yourself, your going in and your coming out, upon the fruit of your cattle and the fruit of your field and the fruit of your body. This is the meaning of an oath of office. So the oath of office was an intensely religious affirmation. An oath simply meant that. It was a covenant act with God and nothing else. So that the word itself has lost its meaning and its meaning in the last two or three generations, since the Civil War in particular. But prior to that, they knew what an oath meant. Yes?
If you agree with the decrees of the Council of Ephesus, then would you believe that the transubstantiation and receiving of communion would be a humanistic rite?
Yes, it did not come into the church until the 13th century.
Then why did Christ say, "Holy man, for this man, that this is my body with the last supper"?
Yes. Well, he also said, "I am the door," you see.
Yes.
Now, if you take the one as meaning literally, physically, this is flesh and meat, then you have to say it's literal in the other statement which he made, you see, at the same time. Now, this is a point at which, of course, the church has extensively debated and been divided. And both Lutheranism and Catholicism and some of the Eastern churches very definitely hold to some form of transubstantiation. But this was a doctrine that came in much, much later. It was not a part of the original Orthodox belief. Yes.
I noticed on the very beginning, you said that a third ecumenical council, and whereas the other, this recent one, is known as the second, or did I misunderstand when you said in 431 A.D.?
Yes.
Well, what was the number of that council, or did that have a number?
The one, the Ephesus Council? Yes, it was the third ecumenical council.
Well, then why is it they calling the president the second?
I don't know, unless they began numbering from Vatican as the councils of the reorganization after the promulgation of the doctrine of papal infallibility. This was a Vatican council, and the first Vatican Council was in 1870. This is the second Vatican Council in terms of that. But the ecumenical councils of the Church, which alone have authority over every church, are these early councils.
I knew that, and yet at the same time I have wondered why
yes.
It's being called the second. No one.
Yes, it's in terms of the numbering from the Vatican Council.
Well,
you see,
they did call it the Ecumenical Council. I think they did call it a second Ecumenical Council.
Well, the council, you see, is now summoned by the Pope, and it is summoned at his call. It was previously, but not to the same degree. It is no longer under the charge of the bishops who elect a presiding officer and meet, but it is at the call of the Pope. So there is a new numbering in terms of that.
There's also a new meaning. It is truly ecumenical because they think that they're going to be the number of churches.
Well, of course.
I see this Pope appears to.
I would possibly agree, yes. And certainly the ecumenical movement is closely watching the effects of the Vatican Council. They are very closely connected with it in their deliberations. Any other questions? We have time for one more.
I'm a little bit confused about when we should know the things that we're learning in this class. Now, for instance, under the ideal situation, would this information that you're giving us come out in a sermon, or would we study it on our own, or would we learn it as high school students in a church, or what would be the ideal way?
To learn this.
Yes. Would you learn it then during your parents?
Ideally, if we had a Christian order, you would be taught these things in school as a part of your history. Because this is basic. I would say you should get this first in grade school in very simple form. You should get it again in a high school, in university. You should have it in adult classes in church and go into some of its meanings more thoroughly. Because the implications are far-reaching. We've just touched the surface of these councils. And it is tragic that that which should have been taught to the grade school children is not only not taught, but it is unknown even to the clergy today. When you realize the vast amount of money that is spent by various foundations today in translating all kinds of documents, Soviet documents, Red Chinese documents, all kinds of literature from contemporary Europe that is trash. And you realize that the vast part of the minutes of some of the councils has not been translated. Some of the great church fathers have not been translated. There is so much that just has not been touched, that is essential. We are in ignorance about our history. And of course, this is not unintentional. We have a great deal to do to recover our heritage. Yes.
Does the divine right of kings come in the category of the state or the
Yes, the divine right of kings came directly out of Greek humanism. When Aristotelianism was revived and introduced into Christian Europe, the same concept was reintroduced. And the monarchs of Europe very quickly picked it up. And as a result, you had the divine right of kings. And it is simply this old pagan statism, the state as man's savior. In England, for example, one of the things that was regular ritual was to bring the sick and the blind and others to the King of England for the king's touch. Because since he had represented the power of God on earth, almost an incarnation of God, then he had the power to heal. So that these people would be lined up for the king's touch. And this continued in England well past the time when the United States was first settled. You can understand, therefore, what it was that the Puritans who fled from England were escaping. It was this kind of total statism and substitute for Christianity. Yes?
Now, I noticed that LBJ wants to reach out sometimes and touch the people. And I guess that he's kind of infected with that idea, wouldn't you?
As to that, I don't know, but certainly in his speeches, he does plan to save the world. And he is going to deliver, he says, the world from all problems, sickness, hunger, poverty, ignorance, and so on. So his speeches outline a plan for total salvation. And this is the meaning of the Great Society. It is the saving society. It's going to be God incarnate, as it were. Yes.
The humanists are looking for salvation by the state. That's much different than we are. I mean, it all has to do with this world. It's not.
Yes.
And if they can prolong life, isn't that? It's just a matter of here and now. That's all it is. Isn't it?
Exactly.
Salvation is looking for just this life, period.
Right. And, of course, prolonging it indefinitely so that they can have eternal life here and now. Yes.
I mean, it's limited.
It's very limited. I've been amused lately to read some of the scientific comments of some scientists on this freezing plan, on the total ridiculousness and absurdity of it. And yet, the two or three scientists who pointed out the absurdity are overwhelmed by the great majority who say, of course, it isn't possible. But what's wrong with experimenting? In other words, they're going to move ahead in the faith that because man is God, he's going to do the impossible. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, this is sort of a PowerPoint thing. What did that sir actually do? Now, the power of positive thinking certainly does not work in a culture where there are a great many hardships, let's say, in Europe, and through famine and plague and all that sort of thing. But is that peculiar just to this country that really started here?
No, the power of positive thinking, in its modern form, of course, you might say did start here, but it's very ancient. If man is God, then his thought is creative. We are told that God spake and his word was created. He created the heavens and the earth by his word. Now, if man is God, just by saying so, he can make things come true. There's a periodical, Humanity is the name of it. In fact, it is the periodical issued by the some kind of national council of seminaries, and by college and university chaplains, and this includes not only the Protestant and I believe the Jewish, but also the Newman House chaplains. And the leading article in the current issue is a very interesting one. The article, of course, is very much to the left in its view on Vietnam, on communism, on all things else. And we are to think in terms of peace, absolute brotherhood. Why? Because our thinking is going to create the world, because man is the only God there is. And if all men make up their mind, or enough of them, that this is going to be, it will be. And the power of positive thinking, you see, rests on the concept that since man is God for these humanists, man's thought will be creative. Yes.
Now, where do you put the libertarians? Those that are not Christian, many of them are.
The libertarians are humanists to the core.
But they're not looking to the state for salvation, because they don't want a government.
That's true, but they are looking to man. In other words, each man is capable. He doesn't need the state. But the answer of Marx is this. Marx said it's either this kind of total anarchism or total statism. And he said total statism makes more sense. So Marx was ready to agree with these libertarians. Only, he said, it's not as workable. It leads to all kinds of problems. So why not total statism? Instead of a lot of little gods running around, have one big collective god and you're better off.
How about kissing a blarney stone and you have nothing to worry about? It's as far reaching that, instead of like the touch of the king's hand,
yes,
or being blessed by some person, which is the evil today, doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Back in Calisthenics, I'd like to know more about the actual meeting. Who was there? How long was it? How did it happen? Who called
the meeting? The councils, the first six ecumenical councils, were usually called by the emperor, the Eastern Emperor. Now, this was a technicality. What usually happened was that some prominent father of the day, a theologian, would get the emperor's ear and ask him to call the council. Now, the emperors were not always happy with the results. In fact, they were almost always very unhappy, and that's why the councils didn't meet more often. But the pressure of the theologians in the church led to the calling of the council. The councils usually tried to meet fairly briefly, a matter of a few months at the most. Very careful minutes were taken of the meetings, and you can find these in Means Petrology, M-I-G-N-E. They're quite full. And you also have, of course, the decisions on every point recorded.
So all that material would be available to people studying the today.
Right. And yet, it's unknown, totally unknown, even among churchmen. Yes.
A churchman of Harry's mentioned said instead of the Holy Trinity today, we have the unholy Trinity of Marx and Freud and Chardin. How about Chardin? No, I thought that was great.
Yes.
What? How does the Chardin differ then from the Hegelian humanistic philosophy?
Chardin is definitely in the Hegelian tradition. Very, very definitely. It's just a variation, and you might as well get it straight from Hegel. Chardin's influence is frightening. When you realize that 10, 15 years ago, he was barely in the church, and any day might have been kicked out, and only by keeping his writings silent did he survive. Today, he is one of the most influential of all figures. But his works are very definitely far out. He denies the infallibility of Scripture in favor of the infallibility of this evolutionary process. And he does use the term infallibility once with reference to it. So it's a shocking system. He belongs in the unholy Trinity. Yes. Chalcedon was a fairly small community within the boundaries of Byzantium in what we now call Asia Minor, so that it was not too distant from Constantinople. No. At this time, the great theologians were all in the East, and this is the one council that is dominated by someone from the West, St. Leo. Yes?
I was reading my paper about Johnson's New War, trying to call it the New War of some sort.
Yes.
To me, it was humanistic from start to finish, because he was going to get everybody a college after education, anybody that was broke, he was going to see they had money, mm-hmm. and all those things. And, I mean, there's no thought of responsibility.
Yeah.
Would you care to comment on a silly thing like that?
Yes, it is a program of salvation. And you see, to him, politics means salvation. They no longer think of the state as the ministry of justice. Justice has nothing to do with it. You're going to save man. But here is a program of salvation that doesn't change man. Christ changes men. He makes them new creatures. He gives them a new heart. But the state takes men and their sins and says, you are now saved because we're going to save you. So that it gives them all kinds of privileges which only confirm them in their sin and depravity. So the salvation of the state only leads to greater crisis and catastrophe.
Well,